Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. They say that nothing is as certain as death or taxes. Well, let's throw politics into the mix because it seems there are very few weeks, days, or even hours when we are not looking at some kind of political discourse. 2012 was especially intense on all levels. Our guests on today's program have been right in the middle of it and will continue to be so in the year ahead. Joining me in studio on today's program to take a look at last year's highlights and lowlights are panelists who have been a big part of our Decision 2012 coverage. Joe Manis, political reporter for the St. Louis Beacon, Dave Robertson, political scientist with the University of Missouri-St. Louis, and Chris McDaniel, St. Louis Public Radio election and Beyond November reporter. A little later, we'll hear from Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Thank you all so much for being with us. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas holiday.
Yeah.
Very
thank
nice.
You're all looking a little tired, but I guess that's to be expected. Again, thanks for being with us. I'd like to begin by asking each of you to give me your most vivid recollection of this last political year. Joe, I'll start with you. I can almost guess what it's going to be, but go ahead. Go for
it. Yeah, but I'll just take one aspect of it. I mean, the obvious one is Todd Akin, the congressman from Wildwood, who became a national phenomenon when he made his observation about legitimate rape victims not getting pregnant. But my most vivid memory of all that, though, was actually two things related to that. First, I was with John Bruner the morning of the Republican primary, and Bruner was the one who was supposed to win, and he thought he was going to win, and he was convinced this was at the outside the polling place in West County, and he was exuding confidence. And here it is, like 8-9 hours later, I'm hearing from some of his advisors who I knew really well, who were calling me privately, this is like by 7:30, saying it's all over. And you fast forward then to just a couple days before the general election, and I'm with Akin, and he's doing his last big rally, and it's at Westminster Christian Academy, which is one high school out in West County. And there were all these people there, and the excitement was in the air. And, of course, these are all fellow social conservatives. And he was convinced that he was going to win. I mean, this wasn't a case of, I mean, I've covered a lot of candidates, and there's candidates who hope they're going to win, who say things look good, and then there are candidates who think this is going to, you know, this is going to happen. And part of it, I think, is because Akin has very strong religious beliefs and really believed that, you know, there was a hand behind him beating Bruner in the primary that nobody thought he was supposed to win. All the polls showed him third. And here it is 2 days before the election, and he's convinced. And just those two things stick in my mind. You know, Bruner being so convinced that, okay, a few hours, it's all over. And it was over for him. And then the same thing with Akin just 3 months later. And I think it's been so difficult for him. I've been trying to get him for weeks. And other reporters have too. And he's been pretty much, he has been in Washington voting, but he hasn't been talking to hardly anybody. And one of my close sources who's very close to him said the problem is that he was convinced he was going to win. And when it didn't happen, he's had a hard time dealing with it.
Well, we talked to Rob Koenig the other day, your colleague, and I asked about Todd Akin, and he said, well, he's looking for work. So many of them don't come back. I mean, I suspect he will, but who knows? He might stay in Washington and find something.
I don't think so. I think Akin will be back out in the Midwest. Yeah. I think he's hoping that one of these conservative groups who'd backed him might use him for something. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dave Robertson, how about you?
Well, speaking of misplaced confidence, the thing that stands out to me is the victory of Barack Obama, solid win despite the sluggish economy and despite the overwhelming, apparently, confidence of the Romney campaign that they were going to win. And they were shocked on election night. And the analysts who lean conservative in many cases also were equally shocked. Karl Rove refused to admit that Ohio was going to go for Obama, but it did.
Did I imagine it, or did Mr. Romney's son say something the other day to the effect that his father didn't really want to be president?
Right. There's an excellent story in the Boston Globe about the Romney campaign in which his son says, well, he didn't want to run again. And it sort of glossed over the decision to reject that and to actually run again. You know, the bottom line is he's been running for president more or less for 6 years, didn't win this election. And like Todd Akin, Republicans are having a hard time coming to grips with this.
Well, the chances are he won't run again, I would suspect.
I think that's right.
After this most recent term. Chris McDaniel, how about you?
Well, as a political reporter in Missouri, I think it would be disingenuous to bring up anything other than Congressman Todd Akin. What struck me most about his campaign, though, was his first appearance after his legitimate rape remarks. His first appearance back in St. Louis was at this rally called Missouri Women Standing with Todd Akin. So I went out to that to cover it for St. Louis Public Radio. And what I was most struck by was just the lack of diversity in terms of the people who were there. He was catering to a very specific audience, middle-aged Christian conservatives, evangelical Christian conservatives. And I asked him about it at that event. This was his first time that he was back. And I asked him if he was worried at all that he was only catering to this small subset of people. And he said that he didn't understand what I was talking about. He said that he saw a great amount of diversity in this. And that's when I realized that this campaign might have some problems.
You know, I never had the impression, and I talked to him a couple of times during the campaign on this program, that he really felt that what he said to Charles Jaco was outrageous or even wrong.
Well, it is something that is held in some firmly conservative groups. It's not like he's the only one who believes
this.
But not the word legitimate. That was an error.
Correct. But as far as I wouldn't character – a lot of people have been characterizing it as a gaffe, and it's not.
Right.
It's something that a lot of, fundamental conservatives believe.
And, well, and the difference is between rape that is – involuntary and some notion that there is somewhat less of an involuntary style of rape, of a non-forcible rape of some kind.
Sure.
And that's what the controversy is.
Yeah, because the same thing was with the presidential campaign, because this all was related to that.
Right.
Paul Ryan and Akin had been co-sponsors of this bill, which basically would have allowed any sort of government spending or recognition only for forcible rape, and that was the words they used.
Yeah.
But, you know, legitimate rape in and of itself was certainly got the attention.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But to me, the real kicker here was when he said that women have this capacity somehow to be able to shut down the pregnancy if, in fact, they get pregnant.
Well, see, because that – yeah, and Chris is correct. This goes back to some studies that conservatives cite, and I want to emphasize there's been many studies, legitimate scientific studies, that say no, that there is no such defense. But that said, some really strongly believe that, which then makes it easier to say we don't need to allow government spending on this, or we don't need to allow any sort of public involvement in this if you believe that it doesn't really happen in the case of legitimate cases.
Yeah. It's important to say that it's almost impossible to overestimate the international impact of this story. It was on news all over the world in lots of different languages and made Missouri Senate race a focus of international attention, almost the equal of the presidential race. Akin's name was all over the world.
But I think there's also this other connection between this and the presidential contest, aside from that, is that in both cases, there was a lot of polls out there. And, and I'm big on looking carefully at polls. But there were a lot of polls out there that were making it clear to the Republican establishment, some Republican conservatives, that their candidate was in trouble. We're not talking just about Akin, but also Romney. But there was this mindset that those polls were wrong based because they challenged the demographics, you know, because they mm-hmm. were saying Democrats aren't going to turn out like that.
Right.
Now, and that's the way often I approach a poll is I look at the demographics, right. well, is this going to be realistic or not?
Right.
But it was fascinating to me that if you looked at all the polls that were out there by all the different groups, 75% to 80% of them, it was like between Aiken and McCaskill, I mean, that showed her either slightly ahead or her own poll showed her well ahead, and all of us discounted it. Turned out her own poll yeah. was the best, had the best demographics behind it. And but in the presidential race, too. So mm-hmm. it was this kind of a mindset that, no, that cannot be right.
Right.
And so that seems to be the mindset in all of these controversies. It's the one common element that this is the way it's got to be. It's got to be this way. And then when it doesn't turn out that way, you know, then it's,
right.
they can't deal with it.
There's real connecting, again, Aiken's rape comments to these estimates of the polls and other things, too, like climate change. There's a real reluctance to embrace objective scientific evidence if it conflicts with the way you want things to turn out. And that's a problem. It's a problem on both sides, but this year it was really emphasized for Republicans.
Well, and the whole Aiken controversy then, I think, made it so that when this happened in Indiana, which is my home state,
right,
Murdoch.
with Murdoch,
yeah.
that it just kind of blew up so yep. quickly. And within days, Murdoch had gone from having right. a comfortable lead to being 10 points down. Right. And this was Indiana, where the waves of change have actually, I would argue, have moved more quicker than in Missouri, because mm-hmm. Indiana had actually gone for Obama
right,
in 2008,
right.
and all the polls showed he was going to, which, and he did, lose yeah. in Indiana heavily. So in some ways, you can definitely say that the Aiken controversy
right.
contributed to the furor in when happened with Murdoch. Then the progressives used that both of those to kind of craft this narrative, which may arguably have appealed at least to some mm-hmm. Independents, especially women. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of connected in the
yeah.
whole presidential
yeah.
case. So it became this whole fit. And I think that's one of the
yep.
reasons the Democrats made several gains in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Senate. This
right.
is all related.
Right.
Chris, anything you want to add? I have to take a break, but I want to get your final word on the Aiken story.
As far as, you know, the Missouri state government, a lot of people on the Republican side of the ticket were very quick to blame Congressman Todd Aiken for their loss, you know, whether or not that mm-hmm. is something that you can quantify, you know.
Yeah, the
really
statewide,
can.
Yeah, because Democrats carried all but one statewide office, even though the Republicans did do really well on the legislative
right.
level, but that's another
yep.
discussion.
Well,
yep.
politicians will often find something other than their own incompetence or irrelevance or whatever you want to call it to blame when they lose an election.
Yeah, but Missouri was definitely in the middle of the national debate.
Oh, yeah.
It just
no
wasn't.
Question.
It just wasn't the way we figured.
Yep. Right.
Exactly right. That's Joe Manis of the St. Louis Beacon. Dave Robertson is with us from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Chris McDaniel of St. Louis Public Radio and Beyond November with us in studio. We'll continue our conversation. We're doing kind of a, if you will, a retrospective on the political season. And Amanda Vinicky from Illinois Public Radio is going to join us in just a moment to talk about some of the things that went on in that state during the course of last year. But let's take that break now. 3-8-2-8-2-5-5 is our number if you want to get into the conversation. You can send us an email, stlpublicradio.org, or tweet us or reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our discussion on the 2012 political season. With me in studio is Chris McDaniel from St. Louis Public Radio, Dave Robertson of the University of Missouri St. Louis Political Science Department, and Joe Manis from the St. Louis Beacon. That would be stlbeacon.org.
Yes,
is that
thank
correct,
you.
Joe?
Yes.
and joining us now is Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio. She's the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
Hope you had a Merry Christmas, Amanda.
I did, most certainly. Same to you.
Well, have you been giving some thought to the past year in Illinois politics? As always, a lot going on there. What stands out in your mind?
You know, there is a lot going on. I was just listening to the show, and so, of course, you look back at the elections. And I do think that it is telling that Illinois Democrats this year during the election not only held their majorities, but they gained. So we'll be entering the new year, with the swearing on January 9th, with Democrats having even more control of the House and the Senate in Illinois. And that's remarkable, given that just after New Year's of 2011, it was Democrats who, without any Republican votes, passed an income tax increase. So when you're looking at the election and all of this thought to, you know, finances and lowering tax rates, Illinois Democrats passed one and nonetheless won re-election. And, of course, some other political stories of note from the year, Governor Rod Blagojevich is now in a Colorado prison. That's something that happened early on in 2012, but nonetheless one of the top political stories here. And then I think also this year, we had three sitting legislators, not one, not two, but yes, three sitting legislators who were charged. So arrested for different reasons, one of them a bribery charge that Representative Derek Smith, who in that election, although he has not yet faced trial, and he says that he's pleading not guilty, but he won re-election even after that indictment. So he, as well as Representative LaShawn Ford, and then Donnie Trotter for a gun charge. So those are kind of the political highlights, I would say, or at least a few of them.
And let's not forget former Governor Ryan, who is still doing some time. He hoped to get out this year, but that, of course, didn't pan out.
Exactly. He is still in prison. He is hoping to get out soon. But yes, he's still there, and also a major political power broker who hails from Springfield, but Bill Cellini, who's been around, and anybody who follows Illinois politics knows that name, and he had is thought of as very smart, very connected, but he also got caught up in the Blagojevich tangle, and he was found guilty this year as well.
You know, it seems that most of the reports we're getting out of your office, Amanda, are dealing with pension issues in Illinois. Is the state, is the government any closer, do you think, in resolving these pension problems?
You know, perhaps we'll have to talk more about that in coming weeks. It's really hard to tell. The House and Senate are coming back for a lame duck session, and that's when that aforementioned tax hike had passed the last time around, when you have all these legislators who aren't maybe quite as culpable because they don't have an election on the horizon. They'll be coming back, but both the House and Senate canceled days. There does not seem to be any agreement. I know plenty of talks going on, even perhaps today, people are not taking a long holiday break as they attempt to resolve the $97 billion in climbing pension unfunded liability that Illinois has. So that is definitely in a lot of, you know, the calculus is the story of the year. A lot of people say Illinois' unresolved pension debt is one, because it continues to be the biggest burden on the state budget. And as we all know, love makes the world go round, but I think a lot of people would argue money. And at the very least, that's what makes the state budget and a lot of the groups and people who depend on it. And that has carried over to kind of other political highlights of the year. For instance, the governor and his fight with unions. And in part, that is over pensions, but it's over a lot else. It's over how much laborers are paid. It's how much AFSCME members is Illinois' largest public employees union is there fighting to stave off closures, but it looks like Quinn will be going ahead with those. He's recently won some court battles to close prisons and mental health facilities. So you look at the impact that pensions has on both those, you know, politics and Governor Pat Quinn's own political future, but also on the state's finances and cuts and closures that are affecting people.
Well, he may be looking over his shoulder sooner than he expected, because I understand that Bill Daley is weighing the possibility of running for governor in Illinois. That's more or less breaking news that just out the last couple of days. What are his chances, do you think?
You know, Daley, of course, is a big name in Illinois, so you can never discount that. And also, Pat Quinn has been an outsider. That's how he rose through the ranks. Of course, now he is an elected governor, but he got to be that way kind of on the coattails of Rod Blagojevich, something that he doesn't like to be reminded of, I think, and talk about shoulders, and maybe a chip on his shoulder for that. But nonetheless, he has kind of remained that outsider position. I don't think that he has the best relationship with House Speaker Mike Madigan, President John Cullerton, who control so many of the dollars in Democratic circles and a lot of the power as well. So it would be a very interesting battle to see. I think Democrats want to keep a Democrat in control in many ways, and yet redistricting is over. That's what helped Democrats and propelled them to this lead, but they don't have to worry about that for another decade. And I think that there is a lot of frustration internally and externally with the greater public, but internally with Democrats, with Governor Pat Quinn. He, of course, doesn't see it that way. He says that polls that show him down are just because he's making hard decisions that people need. And I'm not sure who else will enter the fray as well. When you have an incumbent, even one as unpopular as Pat Quinn, it's hard to unseat him. But again, with a name like Daley and with the connections Daley has, there could very well be an inroad. And Pat Quinn, as you said, should be looking over his shoulder, kind of getting a neck pain, I would say, if I were him.
You know, one other, Dave Robertson.
Well, I was just going to ask, the name Daley is a big name in Illinois, but it's not necessarily a positive name outside the city of Chicago, including the suburbs. And I'm wondering if Quinn has some advantage as an outsider from the near west suburbs who can, you know, sort of parlay. Is Daley the kind of...
Right, does it hurt him? Uh-huh.
Right. Are there other Democratic candidates, like, say, a Madigan, who might step forward?
It really remains to be seen. Attorney General Lisa Madigan's name has been mentioned time and time again as possible a gubernatorial candidate, but for, you know, pick a higher office, and Lisa Madigan's name is mentioned. Yeah. She's made no such motion. She hasn't really denied it, but she, it doesn't seem to be getting to that point in time. Who knows? I like to say that I think a lot of times these politicians themselves are making their calculations and weighing every move depending on what somebody else does. So, it could happen, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And you don't see, of course, a ton of Republicans lining up to make a gubernatorial bid, but not many Democrats. And I do think that, as you said, Bill Daley is one that's gotten a lot of attention. He has, you know, definitely been welcoming it, it seems, in a very careful, politically plotted way. Yeah, the name is not necessarily one that I think people would embrace outside of Chicago. There is a definite Chicago versus the rest mentality. That said, Governor Pat Quinn is not popular downstate either. You look at his election totals, and he hasn't helped himself there. A lot of the closures that I talked about really affect these communities outside of Chicago in a major way. They're the employer. They are going to be very detrimental for these smaller towns, areas in southern Illinois, where there's the, you know, kind of the cyclical effect of unemployment. And I think that there are we're going to see a lot of kind of heartbreaking stories from those areas.
In the time we have left, did you want to say something?
Yeah, there? Yeah. I wanted to ask her, with all this intrigue on the Democratic side, though, is there any sort of major Republican? I mean, this reminds me a little bit of California about a decade ago when you had Gray Davis, who wasn't the most well-known or popular governor. But they, but I mean, is there's there are Republicans had a Schwarzenegger type. I don't know. Does I don't know if Illinois has any sort of major Republican figure right now who can challenge, who could take advantage of all this Democratic turmoil? Is there?
Not that I have seen. You have seen outsiders, so Bruce Rauner, for example, who's a businessman looking to get in, and then a lot of the folks from 4 years ago who had made plays, so looking at Kurt Spiller, Bill Brady, both sitting senators, possibly Aaron Schock, who is a congressman and has gotten a lot of attention on the national level. So a lot of names, but so far you have not seen the GOP coalesce around any one candidate, and I think that's going to remain their biggest challenge, this their own kind of I'm not going to be sure that it's fighting within the party. There's an element of that as you look at the national level as well, the moderates versus the conservatives. But in Illinois, I think it's bigger than that. It's just a lot of ego, a lot of individuals wanting to get in, not willing to step down, and the party not being strong enough or willing to say, no, we want you in picking one individual so they don't come out of a primary all battled and bruised, or even just so that everybody can come together and focus the fundraising dollars. That hasn't happened. So, again, another advantage, Quinn. I'll quickly add that I think perhaps given what happened in Newtown and also a big story of 2012, the Supreme Court just issued something that basically Illinois is the only state with a ban on concealed carry of guns, and that can no longer be the case. Look for that to be a story in 2013, as Illinois has to pass some sort of law, according to this court opinion, that will allow individuals to carry weapons. But again, this Newtown shooting, I think, coming into play as well. So we'll see, I think, a lot of the candidates, whoever is looking to run for governor or other statewide office, have to come out with a position on that.
Amanda Vinick, we want to thank you so much for filling us in on the things that people are talking about in the state of Illinois. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we wish you a happy new year, and it's certainly going to be a busy one.
The pleasure is mine, and here's to 2013.
Indeed. Thank you, Amanda Vinicky, who is the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Appreciate your being with us. I'm glad she mentioned the conceal and carry situation in Illinois, because that is an issue, obviously, much discussion recently because of what happened in Connecticut. But it's also an issue here, Chris McDaniel. The legislature here is going to be dealing with gun control issues in the next session.
They absolutely will be. And in Missouri, I would be very shocked if there's any sort of further restrictions on guns. We have a we have a state legislature with Republican supermajorities in both houses. But what they're looking at proposing is a bill that would allow teachers to carry firearms into the classrooms. Actually, what's noteworthy is that Governor Jay Nixon released a statement on Monday on Christmas Eve saying that he took a stance on it, saying that he does not support this. And he sent a letter to all the school superintendents saying
– all 520 of them.
Right.
And I think Nixon – this was significant for two reasons. One, the governor, who's a Democrat, has been – even with – has not said much in the wake of the Newtown shooting. He made a few comments in Jefferson City but didn't do any sort of news conference or – put out any announcements or anything. His letter, which was interesting, and it went out on Christmas Eve, was his first major jumping into this. But I think it could signal a lot of things. The Governor Nixon rarely takes on the Republicans' leaders in the legislature. It's been rare. If you look over the last 4 years, not even a handful. I mean, you're talking maybe two or three instances. But the fact that he's come out early on this one, and the fact that he, just within the last few days, had appointed one of the Republican legislators to a state post, which trimmed their majority down by one. But that's key, because now their majority right now is 109, which is exactly what they need to override a veto, but that's if every Republican in the House votes and with the leadership, and you've got a few suburban Republicans who might not. So the fact that I thought it was intriguing that he did that, a couple days later then he comes out and makes clear, he doesn't say I'm going to veto it, but the signal is, you guys do anything like this, I'm going to veto it. And I think he's counting on that he would be able to withstand any override attempt.
Now, this is something that I would be really interested to get your take on. Do you think that the Republicans would have enough votes to override a hypothetical veto of this? Because this is something that not all Republicans have signed on to. I mean, U.S. Senator Roy Blunt has said that he doesn't think that that should be the takeaway from the Newtown
tragedy. And Blunt's a former educator.
Sure.
So I think that sends a message as well.
He's a former educator, and he has an A rating from the NRA.
Right. So I think, I'm sure that Nixon, who some Republicans, including some close to Blunt, see the governor as the potential opponent to Blunt in 2016 when he runs for reelect. So they're watching this. I think the fact that Nixon jumped in this, made it clear where he stands. I think probably his veto would probably be sustained in the Senate anyway, which also is a Republican majority. But again, it's a couple suburban Republicans who would not go for this.
Right.
But it does also – it aligns him with all the educators in the state, all the teachers who have felt kind of embattled anyway. And – a lot of schools, I mean, I have a lot of relatives in schools, and even some of my relatives who are conservatives are concerned about this proposal because of the liability issues for the school mm-hmm. districts, and because any sort of state law that would allow teachers to be armed really chips away at the autonomy that school districts have. I mean, in Missouri, the school districts are basically their own little kingdoms. I mean, you know, they mm-hmm. pass their own bond things. They have school boards with only a few things. The school districts are pretty much independent forces in the state. And if the legislature were to pass something that would allow teachers or educators to carry concealed weapons, that goes against several state laws that allow them to bar any sort of guns or weapons in their schools. And so it's not just about the guns. It's also about autonomy. I mean, so there's a number of issues here.
This issue has a lot of potential to have explosive publicity over the next several months.
Yes.
And as Joe said, that's unusual for Governor Nixon to be in the middle of something so controversial. What's interesting about this is it connected to the Medicaid stand, where Nixon also came out in opposition to a number of Republican legislators and said we should accept the money from the Obamacare plan to expand Medicaid in the state. And that's going to be another explosive issue and a big one for the state budget. You know, these are a couple of issues that suggest that the governor is going to be in a, whether he wants to or not, be in a much more contentious position over the next several months than he has been.
Which is interesting because, as we've discussed on this program before, he may have national political mm-hmm. ambitions.
Right.
And these are not exactly the kind of issues that could be helpful in a conservative country.
But they could be helpful in the primary.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be helpful for Democrats because this is the same time that President Obama, we're already getting signals that he's going to be a bit more feisty or a mm-hmm. bit more. Mm-hmm. Second-term governors and second-term presidents tend to be feistier, and mm-hmm. sometimes it helps them, and sometimes it hurts them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can, mm-hmm. you know, there's yeah. only, you know, second terms are sometimes not so great because they get themselves out on limbs, but other times it's when they do rather remarkable things. So we'll see which way mm-hmm. this goes.
Yeah. Have to take another break. Let's do that. We'll come back and continue our discussion, a retrospective of the 2012 political season. With me in studio, Dave Robertson, political scientist with the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Chris McDaniel of St. Louis Public Radio, the Beyond November reporter and election reporter here, and Joe Manis from the St. Louis Beacon. Back to continue this discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We're discussing the 2012 political season with Joe Manis, Dave Robertson, and Chris McDaniel. Let's talk for a moment about something that hasn't happened yet, and that would be the St. Louis mayor's race, which is going to be happening in just a couple of months. Joe, I'll start with you on this. What do you think? The Mayor Slay incumbent and Lewis Reed as his opposition?
Well, as your listeners know, this could arguably be a very historic election potentially, because no mayor in the city of St. Louis has ever won a fourth term. Mm-hmm. Only a few have tried, and all of them have failed. And Slay is hoping to make it this time. He does has amassed a huge financial advantage over Reed. He also has cornered some key political endorsements. Anybody who covers politics would say that there was obviously a lot of political elements in Slay endorsing Congressman Clay during the contentious primary last summer between Clay and Russ Carnahan, and Clay's swift endorsement of the mayor for reelection. So Clay, who arguably is the most influential African-American figure, at least especially in the city of St. Louis, showed that with the vote turnout last summer. The fact that Slay is endorsing that Clay is endorsing Slay, whether or not Clay does a lot for him, as far as physically active, it doesn't matter. That really cuts into Reed's efforts to win a lot of African-American support. I mean, Reed is African-American. He has never he didn't run as an African-American, so to speak. He's been more of a transitional figure. In fact, he used to be pretty close to the mayor a few years ago. And you also have new state senator-elect Jim Milne-Nasheed, who's endorsed the mayor. So the mayor has cornered the area on endorsements and on money. So we'll kind of see how that goes. At the same time, Reid's hoping to take advantage of the fact that they're arguing that there's a Slay fatigue out there. You know, I mean, and Slay does have his enemies. Any long-term mayor does.
Chris McDaniel, there was an interesting strategy, I thought, on the part of Francis Slay. When Lewis Reed announced, Mayor Slay said, I hope race doesn't become an issue in this election, which immediately made race an issue in this election. Did
of
you
course.
See it that way?
Yes. It was saying, well, I hope race isn't brought up, but here I am bringing it up. So sort of preemptive strategy. When I talked to Reed about it, he was quick to point that out, that he was not the one who brought up race. And he told me that he hopes this election will not be about race. That's what he's been telling me numerous times. But he has a significant financial disadvantage to Slay right now.
And that often signals that the powers behind aren't.
Now, and it's still very early. You know, you can still enter the mayoral race if you want to. I think the deadline is
January 4th.
So it'll heat up definitely later on. But as of yet, he has a significant financial disadvantage.
The question for an incumbent, whether it's a mayor or a president, is he made enough enemies where there's a coalition of gripers big enough who want change? And if Slay can have a financial advantage, can have an endorsement advantage, but he would have a hard time overcoming that if it's mobilized against him. I think the jury is out on that, but I don't see it myself.
Yeah, I think the fact that he got Clay and, to a lesser extent, Nasheed kind of tamps some of that down. But the mayor has moved on a number of fronts. I mean, really quickly, since now that the city now has control of its own police department, he's put an ally in at the police chief. I mean, he's not letting the fact that he's running for a historic fourth term get in the way of lining things up the way he would like. I mean, I think that's significant as well.
He
is trying to strengthen the power of the mayor's office. The mayor's office has been strong on the bully pulpit, but weak in actual powers for decades.
Uh-huh.
And you've had a handful of mayors who have tried to change that with varying degrees of success, but no long-term success. I think Slay is hoping to change that.
I'd like to ask our listeners to get into this conversation. If they have a top political story they'd like us to talk about, come on in at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Send us a tweet at STL on air or reach us through Facebook. Has anybody else filed in the city on the Democratic side? Is it just Reed and Slay?
I think there may be another. Well, they were waiting for somebody, but I don't know if there's going to be anybody major.
There's one more. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but there is one other candidate
that filed that day. Jimmy Matthews.
Jimmy
Matthews filed that day. I blanked out for a second. He's a former alderman.
Sure.
And
he's
were
also African American.
Yeah, and yes, there were some Reed allies who immediately said, they contended the mayor. Because, I mean, in the city of St. Louis, anybody who's lived here a long time knows that regardless whether Slay said it or not, or meant it or not, the fact is that race has always been a little undercurrent, sometimes stronger than others. It was definitely an undercurrent in the Carnahan Slay contest at
Clay.
The end.
Clay.
I mean, Carnahan, Clay, at the end, and neither candidate pushed it, But then at the polls, it was huge, and it had a trickle down effect. I mean, with Tashara Jones becoming the new city treasurer. All because of this huge African American turnout this summer. So I think there is this. It's like a river. It kind of flows underneath, and sometimes it becomes gets a lot of it does a lot of turmoil, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, St. Louis has a rich tradition too of bringing candidates into the race to draw votes. Does the name Clara Jo Rohde ring a bell. I know it does with you, Joe Manning.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sure. In fact, that'll go back to, this is 1982. This is Vince Schemel was mayor. Vince Schemel was starting to really flex his muscles, was going to try to be much more influential. But what Freeman Bosley's allies did, this is the younger Freeman Bosley, later became mayor. Vince Schemel was very close to Joe Rohde, who was then the circuit clerk and at the time arguably the most powerful Democrat in the city and was chairman of the City Democratic Party and all that. And Freeman Bosley ran against him. But all of a sudden, this unknown person, Clara Jo Rohde, was in the race. And enough people go to the polls and aren't paying attention. And no, people had a hard time even finding the woman. She never really campaigned, but she took enough votes away. It got Freeman Bosley in as circuit clerk, and then Freeman then built it into a powerful position, which then helped propel him to be mayor by the early 90s.
Well, Clara Jo Rohde and Joe Rohde cumulatively had more votes than Bosley, did they not?
Correct, but that's the point. And in fact, Tashara Jones knows all about this because her father is Vervis Jones, who's a former comptroller, and there were some who accused him. I mean, well, actually, that was one of the things that spawned a big federal investigation. They got him on totally unrelated charges, but Vervis Jones the same way, where when he was running for comptroller, all of a sudden there was this accusation that one of the other candidates, a white candidate, was actually a stalking horse, and that's really what started this whole talk about the stalking horses that often show up in St. Louis politics.
And we just want to be sure that we're not saying that Jimmy Matthews is a stalking
horse. No, I want
However,
to emphasize that.
This is not an unknown practice in the city of St. Louis.
All I'm saying is that there's always this talk, but it doesn't mean that it's true. Yeah. But it does affect candidates like Jimmy Matthews because immediately, as I said, I mean, that day, because I was talking to him ever at the election board, that day, he had some Reid allies claiming that he was a stalking horse. So I'm not claiming he is. I'm just saying that the talk is there.
Another of the big stories of the most recent political past has been the fact that Joanne Emerson has decided that that she is not going to run again. She's going to take a lobbying job. What I find fascinating, Chris, I'll throw this your way, are some of the names of people that have popped up who might want to run for her seat.
Well, the one that would have the most, you know, implications for Missouri politics would be if Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder decided that he wanted to run for the Missouri's 8th Congressional District. Because if that happens, currently, according to precedent, the governor, a Democrat, has the power to appoint the next lieutenant governor. But Republicans would not want that. This is the only statewide office that they won, and they want to keep it. So what some have talked about doing in the state legislature is passing a bill that would say the lieutenant governor's race would be decided by a statewide election. House Speaker Tim Jones has already said that if Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder decides to run for the 8th, that he would throw his name into the hat for lieutenant governor's position.
Yeah, but it's not just Peter Kinder deciding. In the
8th
district thing, it's the party picks the nominees for special elections. And Lloyd Smith, who's the current executive director for the state Republican Party and a longtime associate of the Emerson family, also is looking at it. And a bunch of other Republicans, but the conventional wisdom is that this boils down between Lloyd Smith and Kinder. They're both from Southeast Missouri, and it's who can sway enough of the party leaders in the 8th District Republican Committee. And see, they'll be meeting that's going to be coming up. But they can't make a choice until after Emerson steps down. She had said she was going to do so by February 8th. Now she's saying, I had something last week, I talked to her people, that she'll probably leave a few days earlier because actually the House will be out of session. So I think she wants to leave as soon as possible without hurting her district's representation in Congress. But also, there are some who contend that she's also going to be moving when she thinks a certain ally has the votes on the state committee. I mean, the district.
The special election will cost nearly $1 million for the state, too. And if there's another lieutenant governor's special election, that'll be much more expensive because that's a statewide race.
Well, another interesting name popped up just a couple of days ago, and that is Wendell Bailey, who said he'd be happy to do this in a caretaker capacity. Dave, you're smiling. We all remember Wendell Bailey. Yeah.
The memorable Wendell Bailey, who has run for other offices before, not terribly successfully.
Former state treasurer. I don't know as I mentioned that.
And, I'm sure there are other Republicans, as Joe mentioned, who would be interested in lots of different offices. One of the interesting things about the two parties at this point is that they're sort of a pattern where Democrats – well, if this were a sports team, you would say that the – organization isn't so strong, but they have a lot of good prospects. Whereas the Republicans have a pretty strong organization, they don't have so many good prospects. If Wendell Bailey is in these races, you know, you're not getting the sort of a young prospects out there, no offense to Wendell Bailey, that, you know, you expect to bring the party forward. Tom Schweik is an exception to that. But otherwise, you know, the Democrats are the ones that have the Kinder and the Koster and the Zweifel who are ready to move up. So it's kind of an interesting match between the two parties in the state.
Well, and Bailey, I talked to him last week. I've known him for a long time. I'm old enough that I actually covered him when he was in Congress in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And he got outmaneuvered by redistricting because he got tossed into the same district with Bill Emerson. And then moved and ran against Ike Skelton, but lost. But Bailey's argument, depending on how combative things get between Smith and Kinder, I wouldn't discount it. Mm. I mean, what he's doing is presenting himself as a temporary caretaker so that everybody can then organize and mount a real campaign in 2014 and that he would agree not to run. Well, depending on how contentious it gets on the Republican side, if he's got enough friends on the district committee, they might say, well, you know, this will kind of, you know, let Wendell be there a year while we're
figuring it out.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying that depending on the Republicans, that could be an attractive argument.
Mm-hmm. We have limited time and so much to talk about, but let's end it on a note from Ed, who's calling us from St. Louis. Ed, it'll have to be fast, but thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest locally that this is kind of the year of the woman. I was quite impressed that Jones won that race for treasurers, and I hope she cleans up that mess. And one of the aldermen who she beat, his wife is going, you know, trying to clean up the what's happening at the History Museum, because I'm about ready to write a $2,000 check for property tax, and where is that property tax going?
Thank you so much for the call, Ed. Chris McDaniel?
One caveat to the year of the woman. When Susan Monty lost to Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, this marks the first time that there hasn't been a woman in the executive branch in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no woman that, as of January, will hold a statewide office in Missouri. That's absolutely true.
That's right. Robin Carnahan steps down, and her brother Russ is forced out, if you will.
Right, and if Joanne Emerson is replaced by a guy, that's going to be fewer.
I think the only female candidate is Sarah Steelman, who's voiced
interest, but hasn't really acted. But that would leave us with Vicky Hartzler out in Southwest Missouri, but it would be really reduced.
And Ann Wagner.
Right, Ann Wagner, of course, in the 2nd District. But that really, but I think that all said, I think there's no question that the female vote had a major impact in Missouri's elections and also in the national elections. Yep. No
Absolutely.
Question.
And may have an important impact on votes on Capitol Hill with 20 women now in the U.S. Senate, the largest number ever. So we shall see. So much more that we might have talked about, but time is so short. I want to thank you all for being with us. Chris McDaniel, thank you for joining us. Dave Robertson, great to see you again. And Joe Manis, always good to see you. I wish you all a happy new year if we don't see each other before then.
And to you.
Happy great year. And you'll be busy this year just as you were last year, covering politics and dealing with it. A reminder that you can continue to find follow-up information about the 2012 election at beyondnovember.org, a collaboration of St. Louis Public Radio, the St. Louis Beacon, and the Nine Network of Print Media. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Justin Martin about his biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, the architect of many urban parks, including New York City's Central Park, also the campus at Washington University, by the way. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.